All right, there we go. Tuesday night Bible study, Gospel of John. We're going to do about the first half of chapter 18 today. So if you remember last week, we finished up the high priestly prayer, which is chapter 17, and that kind of concluded Jesus' time of teaching and time spending in the upper room with his disciples on Maundy Thursday. The last part of all of that, of those numbers of chapters, was chapter 17, the high priestly prayer. He prayed for his apostles, his disciples, and he prayed for us too. It's a wonderful prayer. And then we looked ahead at the first handful of verses of chapter 18, just because 18 is a little bit longer and I wanted to get a few verses under our belts so that we could do the whole thing in 2 weeks. So just to kind of reiterate, chapter 18, verse 1, when Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples across the brook Kidron, there where there was a garden, which he and his disciples entered. So yes, they went out from the upper room, which was in the upper city. Oh, it's not on the screen. Sorry. Yeah. I got it on my screen.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, let's go here. Let's see. Church camera, that's the problem. It's still set on church camera. Computer.
No signal.
It should come up. There we go. All right. Thank you. Yeah, so Jesus spoke these words. You can see there's a direct chronological link when Jesus had spoken these words, referring to chapters 14 through 17. He went with his disciples across the Kidron into the Garden of Gethsemane. It's not mentioned here, but of course we know from the other Gospels it is the Garden of Gethsemane. And like many people, he had a favorite place there. And Judas knew where it was. Verse 2, now Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples. So Judas knows where to go to find Jesus. So Judas, having procured a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, went there with lanterns and torches and weapons. So he had his band of soldiers. And if you remember last week, I talked a little, or 2 weeks ago, I guess, sorry. I talked a little bit about who those soldiers were. And I strongly disagree with the Lutheran Study Bible. I don't often disagree with the Study Bible. a lot of the footnotes in there are written by seminary professors, some of whom I had in class, and I highly respect them. But I don't know who wrote the ones right here for these couple of verses, because in the Lutheran Study Bible it says these were Roman soldiers. I really don't think it was, for multiple reasons. I'll reiterate them real quickly for you, and then we'll keep moving on. First of all, if you just think about the culture of that time, the Romans didn't care. They considered this a Jewish matter. Pontius Pilate wasn't even concerned about being involved with Jesus until the Pharisees and the chief priests started claiming that, well, he claims to be king. He claims to be against Caesar. Well, now that's a rebellion, that's an insurrection. So then Pilate got involved. Up until then, Pilate didn't care. The Roman soldiers didn't care. So that's the first thing, just looking at the context, the culture. Secondly, it says right here, he procured a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees. The chief priests and Pharisees had no authority over Roman soldiers, but they did have authority over the temple guard. They had their own Jewish temple guard that would keep Gentiles out of the sacred areas of the temple. So that's who was sent. And then there's one more reason that I think these were Jewish temple guard, not Roman soldiers. And that's coming up here in another couple verses. So in verse 4, then Jesus, knowing all that would happen to him, came forward and said to them, "Whom do you seek?" He saw them coming. And so he approached them, right, as they're coming towards him, and "Whom do you seek?" They answered him, "Jesus of Nazareth." Jesus said to them, "I am he." Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with them. When Jesus said to them, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. So this is the second reason why I think these are Jewish temple guard. Because I think I told you, if you remember, Jesus doesn't actually say, "I am he." What does he say?
I am.
I am. Ego, I me. And it's not, that's of course just a reminder, that's a very unusual phrase in Greek, because you can say I am just by saying I need. So if you say I am thirsty, you would just say I need dipsail. That means I am thirsty. So to say ego I me is putting like a double emphasis on the pronoun I, the first person pronoun. So yes, it's very unusual. If these were Roman soldiers, they would have been puzzled. What in the world is he talking about? But these are Jewish soldiers. I really strongly think that. And so because they're Jewish soldiers, and Jesus says ego I me, which is the Greek translation of the name Yahweh, whoa, this Jesus claims to be God. And that's why it says, they drew back and fell to the ground. They were not merely puzzled, they were afraid. What is this? This Judas guy, who's he got us out here trying to arrest? This Jesus says Yahweh. He claims he's Yahweh. They were scared, I think. So, I am, he says, I am, and then again in verse 6 it says, when Jesus said to them, I am, they drew back and fell to the ground. So he asked them again, whom do you seek? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. See, I think this is a little bit ironic here. I get the sense, now this is just my interpretation, not in the Lutheran Study Bible, not in the commentary. I get the sense that they really are a little bit afraid. This Jesus claims to be God. Now our bosses, the chief priests and Pharisees, are all mad because they say that's blasphemy. But look at him. He's claiming with authority that he is God. So they fall back a little bit afraid. And what does Jesus have to do? He has to kind of boost them up and get them going on their task. Who are you seeking? You know, he asks them again. He's kind of get them back into routine. I just think that's a little bit ironic, almost a little bit funny. So he asked them again, whom do you seek? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus answered, I told you that I am he. And actually, I looked it up here. He again says, I am. I told you that I am. He says, ego I me. So if you seek me, let these men go. Now, where did we finish last week? It was like at verse 6 or 7. So I think I've already gone beyond, right? Okay, so I'll just keep going. By the way, this is, in fact, the last place in the Gospel of John that says, ego I me, I am. Jesus doesn't say it again after this. This is the final time that he says that. I didn't count all of them, but I've been pointing them out as we go along. There's, 18, 20 of them, something like that. I don't know. There's a number of spots where Jesus says, I am. All right. So if you seek me, let me these men go. There's a little double meaning here. Because he claims to be God. They recognize he claims to be God. Do the Jews seek God, the true God, Yahweh? Yeah, they do. They claim to, anyway. To seek the true God. So, if you seek me, Jesus is saying, if you seek me, if you seek the true God, then you're seeking me, not these men. They're not God. Let them go. I'm the true God, if you're seeking me. You see a little bit of irony there? Kind of a double meaning almost, because on the surface he's saying, they have nothing to do with this arrest that you've got on me, this arrest warrant that you've been sent to arrest me, so let them go. And then it says, this was to fulfill the word that he had spoken, of those whom you gave me, I have lost not one. So Jesus gets the soldiers to ignore all of his disciples while focusing on arresting him. But the extra double meaning there is that if you're seeking God, which they claim to be, I'm standing right here, he says. I'm right here. I'm God. I am. All right. I looked up where it was to fulfill the word that he had spoken, of those whom you gave me, I have lost not one. And actually, that is just in the previous chapter. Jesus prayed that in the high priestly prayer. He said, I have not lost any, and he's praying to God the Father, I have not lost any other than the betrayer. I don't remember how he phrases it. It's back in the last chapter. So really, this is just fulfilling his own word that Jesus had just spoken, say, an hour previously. Okay? This is not, when it says this is to fulfill the word he had spoken, that's not referring to an Old Testament prophecy. In case it matters to you. It doesn't really. Okay, verse 10. Then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. So Jesus said to Peter, "Put your sword in its sheath. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me?" Interesting, I mean, it's two verses, three sentences. Interesting little tidbit of information here. Simon Peter, having a sword. Now I looked up that word. Did I write it down in my notes? I did not write down the actual word if you wanted to hear it in Greek. But the word actually refers to, in Greek, it does not refer to a broadsword or a long sword that a soldier would use. A soldier typically would have, like what we would think of, you know, think of the Knights of the Round Table in Old Britain or something. And they would have long swords. That's what the soldiers would have, even the Roman soldiers, for fighting. It gives you a farther reach to stab an opponent. This is a second word in Greek for sword, which means short sword. And actually, apparently, if you look up pictures of it, it was more like a dagger. A sword that might be about this long, with a handle on it, and it was intended for, this is interesting. The word is, the word there, I should have looked it up. For tomorrow's class, I'll have to look up the Greek word. It was a sword that was used for slaughtering or butchering animals. And it was a sword that was, because, you know, you can't butcher an animal with a long sword, right? You need a short knife, really, a dagger. And it was also the name of the dagger or sword or knife that the priests would use for slaughtering sacrifices. It's also the name of the short sword that was used by rebels because they could hide it in their cloak and keep it secret from the Roman soldiers. So if they were going to go in to assassinate somebody or start a riot or start a rebellion, that would be the weapon of choice because it was easily hidden. You know, it's only, you know, a foot long or something like that with a handle on it. Okay? That's what this is referring to. So Peter obviously had this hidden in his cloak. So I don't know what that says about Peter. Peter thought there might be trouble tonight. He's got a short sword, a dagger, hidden in his cloak. I do find it interesting that it's the same name for the dagger that is used to slaughter animals and to offer sacrifices. Interesting. What's about to happen here? Jesus will be sacrificed. And he drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. Now, you know, that makes sense a little bit. If he's waving his sword around or threatening, and maybe he swings his arm and the high priest's servant kind of tries to dodge and gets a glancing blow, it would kind of come down your scalp and cut your ear off. That could happen. Okay? Certainly realistic. What's interesting here, which we only get here in John, is that he cut off his right ear, and the servant's name was Malchus. We don't hear that in the other Gospels. We do hear about Peter cutting off the servant's ear. But here we have these extra details. Why might that be? It's actually kind of an obvious answer. When was John written, the Gospel?
100-something.
Yeah, it's like 80 to 90 A.D. So yeah, a good 50 to 60 years after Jesus. It was the last Gospel of the four Gospels written. And it was near the end of the New Testament books. So what's going to be available at this point in time, a few decades after the fact of all these events? People would know. There would be knowledge of who this high priest's servant was and what happened to him. And maybe he still even has the scars where, you know, Jesus quickly sutured it back on so that it would group no.
Maybe he was a convert.
Probably. See, I would strongly think, and this is where other commentators would say, it is strongly suspected in the early church that Malchus became a follower of Jesus. Because we know by looking at all the Gospels, Peter, yes, Peter, the firebrand, gets out his dagger and waves it around and cuts off his ear, and Jesus heals his ear. So it's not a matter of, you know, sewing it back on like a surgeon would. Jesus probably picked up the ear, touched it to his head, and it was healed. A miracle. And Malchus would have known that. And so probably Malchus became a follower of Jesus and was known among the first readers of the Gospel of John. Okay, does that make sense? So these details lend authenticity to the entire Gospel. Again, this has happened in a few places throughout the Gospel, that we get extra little details that show that John was an eyewitness and he was there. Okay. Servant's name was Malchus. So yes, the high priest probably sent a trusted servant to follow the group of temple guard being led by Judas for the purpose of watching and reporting back to him, the high priest. Go follow them. See what happens and come back and tell me. So I have an eyewitness there on my behalf. So that's why Malchus is probably there. So Jesus said to Peter, put your sword in its sheath. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me? What's missing in the events of the Garden of Gethsemane from the Gospel of John? What's not talked about here?
The kiss.
Oh, the kiss? I wasn't thinking that, but you're absolutely right. Judas betrays him with a kiss. That's in the other Gospels, not here. But regarding this word, drink the cup, what is in the other Gospels about the Garden of Gethsemane that's not here? Jesus praying. Jesus prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane, and you remember the events. You can merge the other three Gospels together, and Jesus prayed three times. He went away a few steps, you know, a few yards away, and he prayed, Father, please take this cup of suffering from me. But not mine will yours be done. And then he comes back and the disciples are asleep. And then he goes and prays again. Three times, remember? None of that is here. Why not?
Was it just the three inner circle that were
yes.
sleeping?
Right.
Or maybe the others
with the others were a little farther away. He brought the other three along with him some distance away. And then he left them and went just a smidgen further. And prayed, and yes, so they probably all 11 of them fell asleep, most likely. But yes, the three were the closest. It's not here. Again, I think this is a case of John being aware that the other Gospels have already been written. So he doesn't need to repeat that event. John being the last of the Gospels, you notice how there's lots of events and stories and miracles and teaching in John that are not in the other three. Because he doesn't need to repeat them. However, there is a reference to it. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me? So the first readers of the Gospel of John at that end of the first century AD, they would have read already Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So they heard about Jesus praying, please take this cup from me, but not my will, yours be done. And then some matter of an hour or two later into the evening, when the Judas and the band of soldiers come to arrest him, Jesus already has the answer. I have to drink the cup. Okay? So his prayer was answered already. And so he knows, he says to Peter, I have to drink the cup the Father has given me. The cup of what? The cup of wrath, the cup of suffering, the cup of death.
Does he, any place else, refer to that as the cup? Because it's interesting that he's talking about the cup here right after they have celebrated.
Yes, that is interesting. I don't know. That's a good question. You're making me think. I like it. The two most prominent places are in the other Gospels where he prays, take this cup from me, and then also here where he admits or acknowledges, which is, this is after the prayer, I have to drink the cup. Does he refer to that anywhere else? I don't know. I'd have to do a little research. But that is a good question. And yes, this is happening on the night after he took the cup and said, This is my blood of the new covenant. Is there a connection there? Well, I'm sure there is. All of Scripture has deep, rich meanings. You've given me a curious thing to ponder, Joyce. Thank you. Yeah, I bet there is a connection. If we thought about it enough, or kind of studied it enough, or looked it up, a connection between the cup of the Lord's Supper and the cup he's referring to here. Okay. Other comments or observations? Questions? All right, let's move on. So the band of soldiers and their captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. First they led him to Annas, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. It was Caiaphas who had advised the Jews that it would be expedient that one man should die for the people. I love this paragraph. There is so much extra meaning here. So the band of soldiers and their captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. Now, on the surface, that's just a statement of fact. That's what's going on here. They arrest Jesus. They bind him probably with ropes. They might have had chains, but probably with ropes, and lead him away. But what did Jesus just say? And just moments prior to this, he said, I am. He said, Ego I me, Yahweh. What did they do? They arrested God and bound him. See, for me, as a preacher, I'm thinking, oh, this is rich with meaning for a future sermon. The problem is this never really comes up in a scripture reading in the regular lectionary. Do we ever act like the soldiers and the officers of the Jews and arrest God and bind him? Oh, all the time. God, you know, I'm in the midst of doing my own thing over here. I'm wallowing in my own sin, and for the moment I like it, and I just like doing my pet sin over here. You just stay over there, God. I'm going to bind you, God, so you're not troubling my conscience while I'm committing my little pet sin over here. Go stay over there. We arrest God and bind him to keep him away from us when we feel like indulging in sin. Does that make sense? That's how I read this. It's a commentary on human nature. That's what's going on here with John, the Apostle John, writing this. So yes, they arrested Jesus and bound him. And I can't help but think of the image from the Passion of the Christ, when they arrest him rather harshly and bind him. And how many of you have seen the Passion of the Christ? Most of you. A very moving film. Well done. But in that one, Jesus says, Ego I me, and you see them all fall back. And then in the movie, they depict them, and they kind of edge toward him, and they circle around him. And then they all jump at once and grab a hold of him and then start wrapping him with chains. So I think that's a good visual image. What do? First, they led him to Annas, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. We know from history, Annas was previously the high priest. But because of something he did, he fell out of political favor with Herod and Pilate. So they deposed him. Now if you know Old Testament law, that's not allowed. The high priest is the high priest. And the duties of the high priest would fall down from father to son. It was a inheritance kind of thing. That it stayed in the line of Aaron. Aaron was the first high priest, then his sons after him. You remember that? So here, the Jews are being manipulated by political forces, because Annas was the high priest and then was deposed, and so his sons, or son-in-laws in this case, became high priests in rapid succession. And so the high priests became a little cozy with the government, because they didn't want to be deposed by the government. Now that wasn't the government's right to do anyway under God's law. So there's a whole bunch of problems here within the Jewish culture and the Jewish hierarchy that are going on here. Plus, the fact that they led him to Annas rather than Caiaphas, what does that mean?
That he was still really in charge.
Exactly! Who's really in charge? Caiaphas, who's technically the high priest by name, or Annas, who's the one who's he's the one who's kind of in charge here, isn't he? Yeah. Again, it shows you a little glimpse of the problems that were going on in the Jewish hierarchy. So they led him to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. It was Caiaphas who had advised the Jews that it would be expedient that one man should die for the people. Remember that happened back chapter 12? I don't remember. That happened in the Gospel of John, where after Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead, and the Jews were all upset because he's making himself out to be Messiah, and Caiaphas actually says, you know, you guys don't understand. It's better that one man should die than the nation should die. Well, and how ironic is that? Yeah. Yeah, Jeannie?
That references John 11, verse 50.
Thank you. There it is.
Nor do you consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people and not that the whole nation should perish.
Yes. And so there was a double entendre, a double meaning back then, and this is a reference to that same double meaning. Because Caiaphas is saying, well, we don't want to all be destroyed by the Romans, so let's kill this rebel. Well, the truth is, Jesus is just that. God says, rather than kill all of humanity and condemn them to hell, I'm going to sacrifice my son. One man dies for all people. So it's expedient that one man should die for the people. So yes, a wonderful, another irony, double meaning there. All right. Questions or comments so far?
Could this also mean that the Jewish people and the troops and so forth still considered Annas their high priest?
That's a good thought.
Not the ones that the Romans were playing with?
Right. You know, I'm not sure, but I would tend to agree with that thought. Yes. That the people themselves, the Jews themselves, still saw Annas as the true high priest, which actually would have been accurate. Mm-hmm. So yes, the Jewish high priestly order is being all manipulated by the political forces. So that's a problem. All right, other questions or comments?
Who was it? The Sanhedrin or somebody who authorized Judas to take the troops out there? In other words, did Caiaphas authorize Judas?
I don't think it says. It says Judas went and made a deal with the high, with the chief priests.
With the chief priests.
So it doesn't name a name, but it was some number of the chief priests who had some level of authority within the Sanhedrin, within the chief priest, the priestly order. Yes. We don't know who, though.
I was just wondering if maybe Caiaphas was in part of that, and Annas had to convince Caiaphas of Jesus' identity or something.
Well, that's possible. We just don't know. But yes, there was some intrigue that was taking place, probably between Caiaphas and Annas and the rest of the priests and the rest of the Sanhedrin, in making a deal with Judas. Who precisely did that, we don't know, but it was someone among them made this deal for Judas to lead us to Jesus. Show us where he is without a crowd, because we don't want to arrest him in front of a crowd that would create a riot. So Judas says, oh, I know where he'll be. Yeah, he'll be right in the middle of the night in the Garden of Gethsemane. I'll lead you right to him. Yeah, Judas betrayed him. But good question. Yeah, we don't know who was the source of that intrigue. All right. Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. Since that disciple was known to the high priest, he entered with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest. But Peter stood outside at the door. So first of all, Annas is referred to as the high priest here by John. So again, that still that reinforces this idea. Who's really in charge? It's not Caiaphas. It's Annas. All right. So Peter followed, and so did another disciple. We know that's a reference to John himself. How does John often refer to himself in his own gospel? He says, the disciple whom Jesus loved, right? He never names himself in his own gospel. I don't know if you remember that. I think we've talked about that in weeks ago. But he doesn't name himself. That appears to be a sign of his own humility. That he was just a cog in the wheel following along Jesus. He had nothing to do. He named Simon Peter often because Peter was brash and bold and involved in things. John is just kind of sitting back watching. So this is John's reference to himself again. So did another disciple. So Peter and John follow. Since that disciple was known to the high priest, he entered with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest. This begs the question, how was John known to the high priest? And actually in the commentary, one of the commentaries I looked at, it asked the same question and said, we really don't have an answer. There's no indication in the Bible or outside the Bible why it is that John the Apostle was known to the high priest. Maybe he did some favor for him. Maybe he worked for him at some point in his lifetime. Maybe he was associated with some of the servants in the high priest's household. Who knows? We don't know why. It's interesting, though, to think.
Maybe Caiaphas was a young man of John's age.
Could be.
And they were
acquaintances in whatever manner, running in similar circles or something.
Yeah.
It's possible.
Which would explain why Ananias had to kind of run things.
Well, maybe. That's a possibility, too. It's interesting to ponder a little bit.
And speculate, right?
And speculate, yeah, right. This is where you get into some of those things like in the movies or in the series Chosen, where they depict things and we're like, we don't know if that would have happened, that backstory would have happened that way or not. This is like that. We're just kind of speculating a little bit, but we don't really know. But the point is, of course, that John was known by the high priest Annas and his household. So John was able to enter the courtyard, but Peter stood outside at the door, verse 16. So the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to the servant girl who kept watch at the door and brought Peter in. So John is well enough known by Annas' household that John can speak to the servant girl who's tending the door and say, hey, he's a friend of mine. Let him in. That kind of reminds me of the days, which in my case were not very long, but the days of going to clubs. You know, a nightclub. You know, I'm 20-something, out of college, not married yet. Oh, yeah, let's go out and have some drinks and go dancing. Maybe we'll meet some girls. I didn't do that very much. Not at all. That was not my scene. But you'd be standing there at, 10 o'clock at night trying to get into a nightclub and somebody comes up and, oh yeah, he's my friend, let him in first. And I'm like, how do they get cuts? Why do they get to go in first? What about the rest of us standing in line? That's no fair. You guys know the picture, right? It's kind of what's going on here. A little bit. So John gets Peter, allowed to come in. Brought Peter in. Verse 17. The servant girl at the door said to Peter, you also are not one of this man's disciples, are you? Now I looked this up because that's a little clunky translation. So I looked this one up and it is asked in a negative manner. And I would have translated it this way after looking at that sentence in the Greek. You're not one of this man's disciples? That's how she asks it. In my personal translation of this. You're not one of this man's disciples? Rather than, how does this say it in the ESV? You also are not one of this man's disciples, are you? It's just a little awkward, I think, in our English phrasing. He said, I am not. And by the way, right there, when he says, I am not, he says, I me. Not ego, I me. Okay, so there again is the difference. Peter does not use the ego I me when he says I am not. All right. So she asks it in a negative sense, so he can just confirm. Well, you're not one of those guys, are you? No, I'm not. That's how it was. That's kind of the sense of this. This, by the way, was the first time, wasn't it? Jesus had predicted Peter would deny him how many times?
Three times.
Three, yeah. So that's coming up. Now the servants and officers had made a charcoal fire because it was cold, and they were standing and warming themselves. Peter also was with them, standing and warming himself. So a typical house in that culture of a higher class house, a rich person's house, the street would go along the various streets through the city, and you'd have a doorway. You would go into a courtyard. It would be an open-air courtyard. I would call it an atrium. And then off of that atrium, they would have their rooms. There would be one room for cooking and eating and rooms for sleeping in and maybe some gathering rooms, and those would have roofs on them. But in your open atrium, you would have a courtyard. The richer you were, the bigger it would be. Now, the high priest, he's going to have a fairly big facility, a big household. So a bigger courtyard, more rooms around it. So they take him to Annas's house, and there they take Jesus into the courtyard and probably into one of the rooms beyond. And that's where they begin to interrogate him. So this is Annas just now. So the soldiers are right outside. They can hear. Doorway's open. A lot of them didn't have doors. They're just openings. And so they're standing outside, but it's cold. You know, Israel does get a little bit cold in the winter and the spring. What time of the year were you there?
Same as you.
January, yeah. February. So, you know, for us, I don't know how many of you heard this, I'll mention it again. So when Glenn went on his trip and when I was there on my trip, we were there in end of January to early February, so that's kind of like the middle of the winter for the northern hemisphere. And for us, the low temperatures got down to, I would say, about 45. Does that sound fair? And the high temperatures during the day when we were there were up around maybe mid to upper 60s. So for all of us from Michigan, we're wearing jackets. We're like, oh, this is nice spring weather. It's still snowing back home. And we're in like 60 degree weather. And all the locals, they have big heavy coats on. Our guide at one point, he's got a parka on with fur around the lining, and he had it all pulled up and he was talking to us. And I'm like, well, there's a difference. Because on the other end of it, in the middle of July, when it's 90-something there, I would just be melting, and he would be like, oh, this is great. So it's probably down somewhere like 40s, temperature-wise, roughly, you know, who knows. And so they're trying to stay warm around the charcoal fire. And I looked up this word charcoal, because I had not encountered this word in Scripture before. So I looked up the word charcoal fire, and that's not quite what it says. The servants and officers had, and what it says is anthrax. The Greek word there is anthrax. And in my Greek dictionary, the definition of anthrax is burning embers, coals. So if you think of, like, if you make a charcoal fire for grill, a charcoal grill, you get the charcoal lit, and then it just kind of smolders, right? But it gives off heat. That's what they had. So the word charcoal is not actually in the original Greek. That's the translators just making a commentary. Actually, what it says is like burning embers would be a little more accurate. But you can still imagine. So they had some burning embers, this pile of embers in a fire pit, and they're all standing around keeping warm. Peter also was with them, standing and warming himself. Okay, the high priest questions Jesus. So then they can all kind of hear, especially if they're quiet and they kind of listen a little bit, they can hear what's going on. The high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. So you got to remember, right there, John and Peter, the only disciples we know of that are in this courtyard, which is probably semi-crowded, mostly with soldiers, and they hear the high priest question Jesus about his disciples. Jesus has been arrested and treated roughly so far. What would you be thinking as one of his disciples? The high priest is asking Jesus about you. And here you are, kind of mingling and trying to hide, probably, among The temple guard. Would you be scared? Absolutely you would be. My whole point is, we don't want to be too harsh on Peter for denying Jesus, because I think it was a very scary moment. Okay? Jesus answered, not directly, he questioned him about his disciples. And Jesus knows, it's not about my disciples. This is about me. I know what you're going to do. I know where this is going. This is about me. So Jesus answers them kind of askance, right? Kind of obliquely, not directly. What does he say? I have spoken openly to the world. I have always taught in synagogues and in the temple where all Jews come together. I have said nothing in secret. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me what I said to them. They know what I said. And I really think Jesus would have said that in just kind of a plain matter of fact. He's like, no matter, Jesus knows in his mind, no matter what I say, you're not going to believe me. But I have been open about everything that I've taught. So ask some witnesses and see what they say. That actually is a good defense. That's a valid legal defense then and now. Same thing now. You know, if you're accused of something, you say, well, go ask those witnesses. They saw the whole thing. Instead of asking me, you say to the judge. Now, how does that appear to a judge, if that's your answer? How does that appear to Annas?
Being evasive?
Yes, I think it does appear evasive. And they know that. Jesus is being a little evasive, but only because he knows they're not going to believe anything he says anyway. So yes, he is being a little evasive. He's being a little insolent, right? It comes across that way.
Belligerent,
yes. He is being a little bit that way.
You know, but also in the Old Testament says it had to be two or three witnesses.
Yes.
Right.
So if he's telling them, hey, go find the witnesses.
That's true too. So Jesus kind of, again, nudging them in the right direction for the process. If you're going to arrest me, and I know you have to, and I know this is where it's going, you need to find two or three witnesses to make this legit. So he's, again, kind of nudging them in the direction they need to go. Stop asking me. Go and find some witnesses. I've spoken openly in the synagogues and in the temple. So, yes, sounds a bit belligerent. I think that's a good word. But it's the truth, and he's kind of directing them in the way they need to go. Verse 22. When he had said these things, one of the officers standing by struck Jesus with his hand, saying, is that how you answer the high priest? So this is the impression of like being slapped. I don't think punched. That's not what's implied here, but slapped. Had Jesus already been treated roughly, physically, during the arrest? Oh, no doubt. And binding him, probably that would be causing bruises and abrasions and things as well. And we also know from the other Gospels, they pulled out his beard and spit on him too. So yes, they were treating him poorly, nasty. Alright, so one of the officers recognizes kind of the insolence, the belligerence in Jesus' voice, and he slaps him. Is that how you answer the high priest? Now, one of the commentaries that I read mentioned that this was totally inappropriate. That under Jewish process back then, just like today, a defendant is accorded some level of protection until convicted. So he cannot be abused. So this, I think here, again, to a first century Jew reading this, is recognizing that Jesus is trying to direct them to go find witnesses, which is correct. He may have had a little tone in his voice, true. But then in a very inappropriate way, one of the officers slaps Jesus, which was wrong. So a first century Jew reading this would get the sense that Jesus is trying to get things directed in the right way, and they are holding an illegal trial, which they are. For another reason. What time of the day or night is it? It's the middle of the night. Under Jewish regulations, you were not supposed to have trials at nighttime, only in daylight. Why? So that everything's transparent and open. So you're not hiding anything. So already, this interrogation and trial is illegal under Jewish law. Okay? All right. Everyone with me so far? Yeah, maybe this is where we end after this couple verses here. Jesus answered him, "If what I said is wrong, bear witness about the wrong. But if what I said is right, why do you strike me?" So Jesus kind of acknowledges this is inappropriate behavior on the part of this guard, this officer. And if I said something that is wrong, tell me what I said that's wrong. But otherwise, you shouldn't have slapped me. No, Jesus is kind of calling him to account. What else was said? There was probably more said here that's not recorded. So John, the apostle, records what he felt was important for us, the future followers of Jesus, to know. This happens throughout gospel, of course, that there's more things that would have said or more details that did not record it. John actually acknowledges this near the end of his gospel, right? You remember? If all the things that were written about Jesus could be written, they would fill, what does he say? I forget the quote now. Fill all kinds of books. There would not be enough books to hold them all. Something like that, he says. All right. Verse 24, Annas then sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. Wait a second, I thought Annas was the high priest. So, see, this is completely illegal under Jewish law. It's at night, Jesus was not protected, he was slapped, he's been treated roughly, he's been interrogated, there's no witnesses. It's not even the true high priest, technically. I mean, it's the high priest who has authority, who they look to. But it's not the designated high priest. So for multiple reasons, this is an illegal trial. To a Jewish mind, they're screaming, this is wrong. This is a setup. It is. They kind of ram it through because they just want to get Jesus accused and convicted and then executed. All right. I think that's a good spot to stop because then the next paragraph, we could do one more paragraph. What do you think? Okay. We still got 10 minutes, right?
Yeah.
Next paragraph is short. Verses 25. Now Simon Peter was standing and warming himself. So they said to him, "You also are not one of the disciples, are you?" He denied it and said, "I am not." This is a repeat. This is an exact repeat of what he said to the servant girl. They also asked the same question in a negative way. You're not one of his, right? You're not one of his disciples. That's how they ask it. Well, if somebody asks you, if there's trouble going on, you're not part of that gang, are you? If a police officer comes up to you, and, were you involved in that? You're not involved in that crime, right? What's your natural reaction, whether you were involved or not? No, I wasn't. That wasn't me. So the question is asked in kind of a leading way. And Peter does go along with it. And again, he says, "I am not." He says, what's the word for not? I, me, me. So I think that's "I am not." But it's not ego, I, me. It's just "I, me." One of the servants of the high priest, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, asked, "Did I not see you in the garden with him?" Again, Peter denied it. So that makes how many times?
Two.
That's the third time now.
Okay.
Third time. And at once, a rooster crowed. Jesus' prediction, prophecy, comes true. The very same night that Jesus predicted this would happen. So one of the servants of the high priest, a relative of the man whose ear Peter cut off. So the word has already gotten around through the soldiers and through the household that Peter cut off, one of Jesus' disciples, cut off Malchus's ear. And Jesus, the man who's being interrogated right now, healed it via a miracle. So first of all, put your mind put yourself in the mindset of one of the household servants of Annas. They're thinking, these guys are interrogating this guy. And on the very night when this guy was arrested, this Jesus guy, he performed a miracle and healed my relative, Malchus, whose ear was cut off. Why are they interrogating him? Right there is proof that he is who he says he is. He performed a healing miracle right on the spot. You got to think, I think, it's not, and again, I'm reading into it, this is not in the scripture, but I got to think there was a lot of mental, emotional turmoil going on amongst the household, wondering what is going on here. This guy claims to be God. Boy, it sure appears like he is. And yet our leaders have it out for him. They're trying to railroad him through a false trial, a faulty trial. Peter again denied it, so that was the third time. And at once a rooster crowed. Do roosters crow only at sunrise, or do they crow sometimes during the night, or if there's a full moon or something like that? Anybody know?
So,
roosters are known for crowing at sunrise, right?
So
if this is a rooster crowing, that means they've been here how long? Through the night. So the arrest took place sometime late into the evening, and then getting him over to Annas' house and Annas beginning the interrogation happens in the middle of the night. And then we see here in the next verse, which, you know, we'll get to. See, this is a longer paragraph, so we'll stop here. Then, and then it says, it was early morning. So, yes, the sun is rising. So, it's been all night. All of these people, especially Jesus, he's been awake for, you know, 24 hours now. And it's going to continue on. No doubt he was tired. On top of everything else, he was physically tired. Peter again denied it, and at once a rooster crowed. And we know from the other Gospels, I think it's Matthew, that when the rooster crowed, Jesus turned and looked at Peter, and Peter went out, and what does it say? Wept bitterly. That is a great translation of that phrase. Wept bitterly. He was sorry for what he had done. He knew what he had done and immediately was sorry for it. Wept bitterly. I like that phrase. That shows a difference between Judas and Peter, doesn't it? And also, as the way I described kind of a typical household plan and how the houses were, you know, Jesus is in that room right there and it's got some of the high priests and the priests and the high priests and they're interrogating Jesus, and then just right outside through an opening, here's an open air courtyard and the soldiers are milling about. Jesus, in that room, could hear the rooster crow, and he could just look out the door, and there he sees Peter, and he knows what happened. And Peter sees Jesus look at him and knows what happened. And that just crushed him. You ever have a child, maybe toddler age or lower elementary age, and they know they did something wrong, and they know you know they did something wrong, and you just look at them, and they just crumble. Right? Is that a good thing as a parent or a bad thing? You know, different personalities, because we, with our four kids, some of them would be a little bit obstinate. I didn't do anything wrong. You can't prove it. Yeah, I know you saw me do it, but I didn't do it. On the other hand, that other personality of children where they are like, oh yeah, I did something wrong. Oh, mom or dad's looking at me now, and they just start crying. Right? Yeah. You know, there's those two personalities. Peter was obviously the latter of what I just described. He just crumbled and cried because Jesus saw, looked and saw him. All right. I think that's about as far as we go, just short of an hour. I don't think we have time to get into the next paragraph without going for a while.
You know why in Mark he says rooster crowed twice? I mean, I think the only one that says twice, but the other Gospels just say rooster crowed.
Huh. I guess I never paid attention to that. Yeah, I guess. Did you look it up? Is that what it says?
Yeah, it says, Peter remembered how Jesus had told him, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times.
Okay. That's an interesting detail. Why is it only mentioned that the rooster crowed twice in the Gospel of Mark, but not in the others? Well, it doesn't really mean anything for us, right? Still the same meaning, but yes, that's an interesting detail. I don't know why. That's a good question. Do roosters keep crowing when the sun comes up? They don't just crow once and stop, right? They keep crowing? I know our secretary, Christy, you guys all know Christy or know of her anyway. They live on some property down near Buchanan. And I'm probably telling more than I should. Their daughter likes animals, so they have rabbits and they have ducks and they have chickens in pens. And she said, this was like a few months ago, she said, that rooster just would not stop crowing. I feel like going out there and wringing his neck. You know, she was like, he won't shut up. And I said, you know, I've never lived on a farm or near a farm, so I can't say that I've ever experienced that.
We had a mean rooster at our house, and he crowed all the time, too.
Really? Mm-hmm. Those roosters.
I remember my dad taught me when he was younger, they had a rooster that was mean, and always chased the kids.
Yeah.
And the dad would always think it was funny, but when it got him once, he was, we had that rooster for dinner that night.
That rooster is the first one picked for Sunday chicken dinner.
And fine, tough, too.
Yeah. All right, any last questions or comments? All right, well, let's rise and close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Thanks for coming. Have a good night.